Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 46, which I will entitle The Prince and the Feast. The date of this prophecy is approximately 573 BC. According to Precept Austin, they are usually a little bit earlier than my estimates. Different dating system I think they used. 572 is approximately what time I have it. It doesn't really matter. It's about 12 or 13 years after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and about 36 or 37 years before the return of the Jews from Babylon to Israel under Zerubbabel. We begin now in verses 1 through 3. We, of course, are in the middle of the last nine chapters of the book of Ezekiel, which one of my commentators said was the most difficult section in all of the Bible. Well, we'll rush in, even though angels might fear to tread here. We've already been going now between chapters 40 and 45, describing Ezekiel's New Covenant Temple. That's what I call it. Some people call it the Millennial Temple. Well, if you believe the millennium is the church age, which I do, then it would be the Millennial Temple. But because of pre-mill presuppositions, that title is somewhat misleading. So we're going to call it Ezekiel's New Covenant Temple, and we're going to take what we see in here as types of what's going to happen in the church. So we begin now in verses 1 through 3 of Ezekiel 46. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. The gate of the inner court facing east is to be shut on the six working days. But on the Sabbath day and on the day of the new moon, it is to be opened. The prince is to enter from the outside through the portico of the gateway and stand by the gatepost. The priest are to sacrifice his burnt offering and his fellowship offerings. He is to worship at the threshold of the gateway and then go out, but the gate will not be shut until evening. On the Sabbaths and new moons, the people of the land are to worship in the presence of the Lord at the entrance to that gateway. Now, I'm going to try to draw a picture of what's happening here. All the gateways can make it confusing. And the courts, there's gates everywhere to the outer court, the inner court. First of all, the gate of the inner court facing east. The inner court is the court of the priest, where the altar of burnt offering stood, and where, of course, the priest would offer sacrifices for atonement. The worshiper would need to get to the priest through the gateway from the inner court to the outer court, and that would be to the east of the inner court, that gateway would be. Now, we'll see as we go through here, the prince, who was introduced in a previous chapter, the prince was standing at the eastern end of the eastern gate, the portico, the porch, the structure that's over the gate separating the inner and the outer courts. He stood at the end of that porch structure that was closer to the outer court, so he could be in connection with the people in the outer court, the worshipers, and also he could be in connection with the priests who are going to be doing the sacrifices in the inner court. Now, in verse 1, this gate of the inner court, which was facing east, is to be shut on the six working days, but on the Sabbath day and on the day of the new moon, the gate is to be opened. Now, let me give you a background verse to this, Ezekiel 44, verses 1 through 2, two chapters previous. The man, that would be Jesus, the man who looked like bronze, the man then brought me back toward the sanctuary's outer gate that faced east, and it was closed. The Lord said to me, "This gate will remain closed. It will not be opened, and no one will enter through it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered through it. Therefore, it will remain closed." Now, that sanctuary's outer gate in Ezekiel 44:1 could either be the eastern gate of the outer court, or it could be the eastern gate of the inner court. That creates ambiguity. And so I've run through several options as to what might be meant by this shutting of the gate. So here are three options as to which gates were shut when. Option number one, the east gate of the outer court was shut all the time, and the east gate of the inner court was shut 6 days a week. The Cambridge commentary and the pulpit commentary hold to that view. Option number two, the east gate of the outer court was open all the time, not shut, but open, and the inner court is shut 6 days a week. If you hold to that option, then we've got a problem with Ezekiel 44:1. The sanctuary's outer gate, assuming that's the inner gate of the courtyard, was closed. But option number two says it's open all the time. We will have to take that opening and exception, the Sabbath opening of that gate, an exception to Ezekiel 44:1's statement that the gate was closed all the time. And that's John Gill's view. Eastern court open all the time, inner court shut 6 days a week, open on the Sabbath. Option number three, the east gate of the outer court is shut 6 days a week, open on Sabbath, and the inner court would be open all the time. The pulpit commentary quotes a commentator called Ewald who holds to that view. Now, of course, that view means you've got to change the wording of Ezekiel 46:1 because it says the gate of the inner court. It explicitly says in verse 1 of chapter 46, the gate of the inner court was to be shut 6 days a week. Well, having looked at all three options, I think option number one is the best. The east gate of the outer court is shut all the time, and that, of course, was to show honor because the prince had walked through that gate at one time. And now the east gate of the inner court is to be shut 6 days a week, open on the Sabbath. It's not only going to be open on the Sabbath, also verse 1 tells us that it's going to be open on the day of the new moon. Now verse 2, the prince is to enter from the outside through the portico of the gateway. I'm assuming that's the inner gate, the eastern gate of the inner court. Who is this prince? We've talked about him a lot. Starting in chapter 44, where he was introduced, I decided that he was a type of the Messiah. He was a ruler, political ruler, as well as a religious ruler, offering sacrifices, as well as a priest offering sacrifices. So he combines priest and king. That sounds an awful lot like Jesus to me. He fits to me as a type. That's controverted, but many commentators say that, and I think that's true. We read in Ezekiel 45, verse 17, that the prince was required to bring sacrifices both for himself and for the people. Ezekiel 45, previous chapter, verse 17 says this, then the burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings for the festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths, for all the appointed times of the house of Israel, will be the prince's responsibility. He will provide the sin offerings, grain offerings, burnt offerings, and fellowship offerings, that's peace offerings, to make atonement on behalf of the house of Israel. Now this prince, according to Ellicott, was required to be present at all times. He's got to handle Sabbath offerings, new moon offerings every month, first of every month, as well as for the three appointed feasts, tabernacle weeks, and Passover. So he was required in chapter 45 to bring the offerings, and 46 directions are given to him for how he's to conduct himself in the worship process. Now in verse 2, this prince is to enter from the outside through the portico of the gateway and stand by the gatepost. That means he's to enter the inner court. He comes from the east, of course. He enters the inner court to give his sacrifices to the priest serving in the temple. He comes from the east, even as Jesus in fulfillment of Malachi 4 verse 2 comes from the east. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness, that's S-U-N, Son, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. Very famous messianic verse, and of course, the sun rises in the east. Now, we've dealt with this before, but I should mention, in case one wonders, why would the Messiah be offering sacrifices for himself? Well, I believe this prince is a type of the sacrifices that were offered by Jesus. Jesus was a burnt offering. He was a peace offering. He was a guilt offering. He fulfilled, typologically, all of those offerings. And that's why he's standing where he is, offering sacrifices for the people in the outer courtyard, and then presenting them to the altar by way of the priest in the temple. And remember, this is a visionary temple. This is what Ezekiel is seeing in his vision. This temple has never actually existed physically. Now, at the end of verse 2, we see the prince standing by the gatepost. Remember, this gate of the inner court, the eastern gate of the inner court, had two doorways because the porch structure opened up on the inner court and it opened up on the outer court. So you had an entranceway on the outer court and an entranceway on the inner court. So in verse 2, when it says the prince is to enter from the outside through the portico, that is talking about the open doorway that faces the outer court. That's where you can see the people. He stands by the gatepost. I'm not exactly sure where the gateposts are, whether they're on the inner side or the outer side of that porch structure, but since the prince is said to be on the outside, we're going to assume the doorposts are on the side facing the outer court. And who knows, maybe there are two gateposts on the inner court too. I don't know. But the prince stands there with access to the people. They can see him. Now, John Gill says this standing by the gatepost is an illusion. quote, "The illusion seems to be not an illusion, but an allusion. The allusion seems to be to the king's pillar in the temple where he used to stand." And then Gil quotes 2 Chronicles 23, verse 13. "And she," referring to the evil queen Athaliah, "looked, and behold, the king was standing by his pillar at the entrance." Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, after examining several Old Testament scriptures, says that Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of the congregation by a pillar, even as this prince stands by a gatepost in the presence of the congregation. The verses he quotes are 1 Kings 8:14, "The king turned around and blessed the entire congregation of Israel while they were standing." 1 Kings 8:22, "Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in front of the entire congregation of Israel and spread out his hands toward heaven." 2 Kings 23:3, "Next the king stood by the pillar and made a covenant in the presence of the Lord to follow the Lord." Now at the end of verse 2, the prince gives his burnt offering and his peace offerings to the priest, and they sacrifice them. Now some people say these priests are symbolic of New Testament priests to go out and preach the gospel. I think that might be stretching the analogy a little bit too far. Now at the end of verse 2, we read, "The priest is to sacrifice his burnt offering and his fellowship offerings. He is to worship at the threshold of the gateway and then go out." That would mean he would go into the inner side of that portico over the eastern inner court gate, and then he would go out of the inner court. "But the gate will not be shut until evening," because the gate stays open on Sabbath, and that would be all the way until the evening. Verse 3 says, "On the Sabbath and new moons," the Sabbath is the seventh day of the week, new moons are the first day of the month, famous festivals in the Old Testament law, "the people worship God at the entrance to that gateway of the eastern inner court gate." The entrance to that gate structure would be on the side of the outer court where the people are, and the people would stand there. That's my guess. It could be there on the other end of the porch structure, standing at the edge of the inner court. I'm not really sure, but the allusion seems to be to the people of Israel meeting at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation during the Exodus, Exodus 29:42. "This will be a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance to the tent of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet you to speak with you." We go now to Ezekiel 46, verses 4 through 8. "The burnt offering the prince brings to the Lord on the Sabbath day is to be 6 male lambs and a ram, all without defect. The grain offering given with the ram is to be an ephah, and the grain offering with the lambs is to be as much as he pleases, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. On the day of the new moon, he is to offer a young bull, 6 lambs, and a ram, all without defect. He is to provide as a grain offering 1 ephah with the bull, 1 ephah with the ram, and with the lambs as much as he wants to give, along with a hin of oil with each ephah. When the prince enters, he is to go through the portico of the gateway, and he is to come out the same way." Now, I'm not going to get into a lot of details as to how big the ephah is or how much the hin of oil is and all that. What I want to emphasize here is how these sacrifices are different than the sacrifices required in the law of Moses. And that difference tells us that this temple is not meant to be a return to the literal temple of Moses. It is meant to be symbolic. Now, the fact that so much detail is given makes us want to say, oh, this is not symbolic. This is supposed to be what's going to happen actually. Well, if you want to go that way, you end up with a so-called millennial temple in the future. And the problem with that is, why in the world would we be having sacrifices in a millennial temple when Jesus himself, previous to the millennium at the cross, has provided all those sacrifices that we need? So I think the detail is to show that the symbolism applies to the prince. All of the symbolism, typology of the Old Testament sacrifices applies to Jesus. And also, we need to be careful in our worship of Jesus. This is not some mystical thing. I mean, we need to be precisely obedient to the Lord. Now, let's look at some of the differences. Verse 4, "The burnt offering on the Sabbath day is to be 6 male lambs and a ram." Of course, they're without defect. All sacrifices were without defect because that's a symbol of the perfect sacrifice, Jesus. 6 male lambs. Well, according to the law of Moses, on the Sabbath day, the offering should be 2 lambs. and one ram. But here in Ezekiel's temple, it's six lambs and a ram. That's the burnt offering for the Sabbath day. We read in Numbers 28:9, on the Sabbath day, present two unblemished year-old male lambs. That's two, not six. So this is a new thing. This is a proof that the ceremonial law has now been abolished and it's been fulfilled in Jesus. Now, there are lots of other things that are different in Ezekiel's millennial temple, different than the requirements of the temple in Moses' law. I'm going to run through very quickly and rehash the differences from chapter 45, our previous chapter. And chapter 45, verse 13, we read this. This is the offering that you shall offer, a sixth of an ephah from a homer of wheat. This is how much grain offering was to be offered along with animal offerings. There was no Mosaic law requirement of a sixth of an ephah anywhere. Ezekiel 45, verses 14 through 15. And the prescribed portion of oil, namely the bath of oil, that's a hen, different translation, a tenth of a bath from each core, one sheep from each flock of 200. Those amounts are not in the law of Moses. In Ezekiel 45:18, we see the sacrifice required in Ezekiel's temple for the new moons. Thus says the Lord God, in the first month, on the first of the month, you shall take a young bull. But in Moses' temple, or tabernacle, Numbers 28:11, then at the beginning of each of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord, two bulls and one ram, seven male lambs. Big difference. In Ezekiel's temple, one bull. Moses' tabernacle, two bulls, one ram, seven male lambs. In Ezekiel 45, verses 19 through 20, we have a ritual of sprinkling of blood that is not in the law of Moses. The priest shall take some of the blood from the sin offering and put it on the doorpost of the house. That's the sanctuary. On the four corners of the ledge of the altar of sacrifice in the inner courtyard, and on the post of the gate of the inner court. Same gate we've been talking about in this chapter. Sprinkling of blood, that's not in the law of Moses. Ezekiel 45, verses 22 through 23. On that day the prince shall provide for himself and all the people of the land a bull for a sin offering. During the 7 days of the feast, this is the feast of Passover, he shall provide as a burnt offering to the Lord seven bulls and seven rams without blemish on every day of the 7 days. Passover and unleavened bread, the 7 days of unleavened bread which came after Passover, and a male goat daily for a sin offering. Well, I'm sure you've never heard of a Passover bull. It was a Passover lamb in Moses' law, and now here in Ezekiel, it's a Passover bull. And the seven bulls and seven rams on each day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is not in the Mosaic law. Rather, it was two bulls and one ram, plus seven male lambs. In the Mosaic law, at Numbers 28:19, you shall present an offering by fire, a burnt offering to the Lord, two bulls and one ram and seven male lambs. But in Ezekiel's temple, it's seven bulls and seven rams, the amount of sacrifices for the Feast of Unleavened Bread at Passover. Those amounts do not match. We read also in Ezekiel 45, verse 24, he shall provide as a grain offering an ephah with a bull, an ephah with a ram, and a hin of oil with an ephah. One bull, one ephah for the grain offerings. One ram, one ephah. That's Ezekiel. But Moses, in Numbers 28:12, 3/10 of an ephah for each bull, and 2/10 of fine flour. 2/10 of an ephah for one ram. So instead of having one ephah for a bull and one ephah for a ram, as Ezekiel has it, Moses has 3/10 of an ephah for a bull and 2/10 of an ephah for a ram. The amounts don't match. Also, in Ezekiel 45:24, we see that the drink offering that goes along with the grain offering is a hin of oil, one hin per one ephah, according to Ezekiel. But Numbers 28, verse 14, we see that Moses requires half a hin for the bull, and a third of a hin, and a third of a hin for the ram. So that's half a hin for 3/10 of an ephah for a bull. That does not add up to a hin of oil per ephah. I don't want to do the math now. I don't want to get any more confused than I already am. But you see there, without going into any more detail, that the amounts are extraordinarily different. Now, these differences continue in verse 5, because not only is the amount of grain offering different for the two different prophets, Moses and Elijah, for the Sabbath, but on the new moon, we have more differences. In verse 6, on the day of the new moon, he, the prince, is to offer a young bull. That's just an extra animal that's added to the requirements of the Sabbath that we just looked at. How is the requirements of Ezekiel different from the law of Moses? The law of Moses required two young bullocks, not one, but two, and a ram, which is the same, and seven lambs. Whereas Ezekiel only has one bull required for a new moon sacrifice and six lambs, not seven lambs. Not only are there differences, but there's no pattern to the differences. In verse 7, the differences between Ezekiel and Moses are continued. The prince is to provide one ephah with the bull, one ephah with the ram. That's the same as the Sabbath offerings. But next he says, as far as the lambs that you offer, you give as much as you please. You give as a grain offering as much as you please, as much as you want. Now that's different from the law of Moses concerning the new moon grain offering for the lamb. In Numbers 28:13, first part of the verse, we read, 2 quarts of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering for each lamb. 2 quarts mixed with oil. But in Ezekiel's temple, it's however much the prince wants to give, it doesn't really matter. It's up to him. That's a complete difference. That as much as he pleases is in verse 7. It's also back in verse 5. I didn't mention it. The grain offering with the lambs is to be as much as he pleases. That's not anywhere in the Old Testament Mosaic law. We go to verse 8 then. When the prince enters, that means when he enters into the inner courtyard, he goes through the portico of the gateway. That's the gate of the inner court that separates the inner court from the outer court on the eastern edge that we've been talking about. He goes in to offer his sacrifices, and when he's finished, he comes out the same way. We go now to Ezekiel 46, verses 9 through 10. When the people of the land come before the Lord at the appointed feast, whoever enters by the north gate to worship is to go out the south gate, and whoever enters by the south gate is to go out the north gate. No one is to return through the gate by which he entered, but each is to go out the opposite gate. The prince is to be among them, going in when they go in and going out when they go out. Now, verse 9 mentions the appointed feast. That, of course, would be the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Weeks, Passover in the spring, Feast of Weeks in the early summer, Tabernacles in the early fall. The pulpit commentator says the appointed feast also include the Feast of the Sabbaths and the New Moons, which have already been mentioned. I don't know if that's what Ezekiel meant. Seems like he's already taken care of the Sabbaths and the New Moons, and he's moving on to the appointed feast. And then he mentions a strange thing. If you come as a worshiper through the north gate, you've got to go out by the south gate. First of all, we need to mention as a preliminary matter that people cannot come in through the east gate to worship because it was permanently shut, if you recall, assuming one of the options as to which gate was permanently shut. I believe it was the outer gate. And so the people have to come in either through the north gate or the south gate. Now we have a problem here, a perennial problem. Is it the north gate of the outer court or is it the north gate of the inner court? Well, if it's the northern gate of the outer court, Ellicott affirms that, and the pulpit commentator affirms that. And as we go on here, I think you'll see that that's the correct option. It could be the northern gate of the inner court. I couldn't find a commentator who affirms that. Now, why are these instructions given? The instructions are given in order to prevent disorder. As Benson says, there being no passage or thoroughfare out of the temple westward, behind the temple, there's no gate there. If they had entered in at the east gate, coming into the outer court from the east gate, they must have returned back the same way they came in, which would have occasioned a vast throng and hindrance, considering the multitude that came to the temple. Remember, these are feast days. Lots of people are going to be there. Now, Benson doesn't mention which east gate he's talking about. People going in through the east gate, through the outer court, or through the east gate of the inner court, in order to present their sacrifices to the priest. Either way, if they did that, it would be mass confusion. People going in, people coming back out. Now, I'm going to give you an option as to how the foot traffic flowed, given that the priest was standing at the eastern end of the eastern inner court door, as I've already said. Now, I could not find any one commentator to discuss this, so I had to piece this together, and I could very well be wrong. Well, first of all, here's what Barnes says. The whole body of the people gathered together in the outer court, and from thence bodies went in turn into the inner court to worship, in other words, to offer their sacrifices, and then again out into the outer court. Now, if the people were going from the outer court to the inner court and then back out to the outer court, and if they were doing that from the eastern gateway of the inner court and going back out through that same eastern gateway, it would be mass confusion. People would be stepping on each other. So here's what I assume that Barnes means. We're going to look at worshipers coming through the north gate. Of course, worshipers coming through the south gate would have the same instructions, mutatis mutandis, but we'll just take worshipers coming through the north gate. They enter the northern gate of the outer court, the outer court. So now they're in the outer court, and now they need to go to the northern gate of the inner court, and there they give their sacrifices to the priests in the inner court. Once they finish doing that, they exit through the southern gate of the inner court, and now they're in the outer court. And once they're in the outer court, they go out the southern gate of the outer court. So the prince, who comes in through the east gate, now, when I say comes in through the east gate, he comes in through the east gate of the inner court. He's got to get there somehow. Maybe he comes in through the east gate of the outer court, and that's an exception to when that east gate of the outer court is shut. Or maybe he comes in through one of the northern or southern gates into the outer court and then goes through the gate of the inner court on the east. That's all speculative. But at any rate, however he gets in to the outer court and to the inner court, he's not going to be messed up with all the traffic coming from the north and the south. That's the best I can do on that. I could be wrong, but it's reasonable to me. Now in verse 10, this prince is to be among the people, going in when they go in and going out when they go out. In other words, he's offering sacrifices even as the people are offering sacrifices. Now, of course, we're taking this prince as to be the Messiah, Jesus. So he's in the midst of his people worshiping. He's worshiping the Father even as they are worshiping the Father. And again, if it is troublesome to think that the Messiah is offering sacrifices, remember that Jesus the Messiah actually did offer all those sacrifices in the form of his body, which was nailed to the cross. We go now to Ezekiel 46, verses 11 through 15. To save some time, I'm just going to discuss each verse as we go through. Verse 11, at the festivals and the appointed feast. These festivals and feasts should be distinguished from the different offerings that were offered for the Sabbath and the new moon. The Sabbath in verse 4, the new moon in verse 6. And later on in verse 13, we're going to look at the daily offerings. So we see the prince is doing all the offerings that a priest would do in the Old Testament, tabernacle and temple. At the festivals and the appointed feasts, the grain offering is to be an ephah with a bull, an ephah with a ram, and with the lambs as much as one pleases, along with a hin of oil for each ephah. We've talked about that before in the earlier requirements for the Sabbath and the new moon. Verse 12, when the prince provides a free will offering to the Lord. Now, a free will offering would be like a peace offering, a thank offering. A free will offering is a type of a peace offering. Whether a burnt offering or a fellowship peace offering, the gate facing east is to be opened for him. So now this looks like an exception to the rule that the eastern gate is shut on every day but the Sabbath. The prince shall offer his burnt offering or his fellowship offering as he does on the Sabbath day. Then he shall go out, and after he has gone out, that means out of the inner court, the gate will be shut. So again, he can get in, the gate shut, but when he needs to get in to do a fellowship offering, the gate's open. Every day you are to provide a year-old lamb without defect for a burnt offering to the Lord. Morning by morning you shall provide it. That's the morning and evening sacrifice, except evening is not mentioned. Why is the evening sacrifice not mentioned? Well, commentators have exposited on this. Options. Option number one, the evening sacrifices is implicitly included in the morning sacrifice. And I think that's probably the best and easiest way to decide this. Option number two, in the future temple, there will be no evening sacrifice. Well, why not? Well, this is what John Gill says. Christ has appeared once in the evening of the world and offered up himself. Yea, it was literally in the evening or decline of the day when he suffered. Now, I have a problem with that. I don't think he suffered in the evening. I think he suffered in the morning on the Friday he was executed. And by suffering in the evening, says Gill, Jesus answered the type of the Passover lamb. So in other words, Jesus fulfills the typology of the prince. I don't know. That's such a stretch. John Gill has got a great imagination, but sometimes he gets way out there into the ether. I don't know why the evening sacrifice was not mentioned. I just assume probably because it didn't need to be mentioned. The prince would be offering an evening sacrifice too. But on the other hand, this might be another difference between the Mosaic laws of ritual and the laws of ritual in Ezekiel's temple. Verse 14, the prince is to provide the morning sacrifice morning by morning, a grain offering consisting of a sixth of an ephah with a third of a hin of oil to moisten the flour. Those amounts, I'm pretty sure, are different than the amounts that were required in the Mosaic law. Actually, I was so tired of checking the differences, I didn't really look that one up, but I'm pretty sure they're different. The presenting of this grain offering to the Lord is a lasting ordinance. At the end of verse 14, a lasting ordinance. Christ, the antitype of the prince, has fulfilled these ordinances forever. And so forever and ever and ever, we have Jesus providing us with these kinds of sacrifices. Verse 15, so the lamb and the grain offering and the oil shall be provided morning by morning for a regular burnt offering. So we now go to Ezekiel 46, verses 16 through 18. This is what the sovereign Lord says. If the prince makes a gift from his inheritance to one of his sons, it will also belong to his descendants. It is to be their property by inheritance. If, however, he makes a gift from his inheritance to one of his servants, the servants may keep it until the year of freedom. Then it will revert to the prince. His inheritance belongs to his sons only. It is theirs. The prince must not take any of the inheritance of the people, driving them off their property. He is to give his sons their inheritance out of his own property so that none of my people will be separated from his property. Now, assuming that the prince is the type of Jesus the Messiah, verse 16 is very easy to understand. If the prince makes a gift from his inheritance to one of his sons, the sons, of course, would be Christians. They inherit eternal life from Jesus. That gift belongs to the descendants, to the sons, to the Christians. It is to be their property by inheritance. That's easy. But in verse 17, we have something that's not so easy. If, however, the prince makes a gift of his inheritance to one of his servants, the servant may keep it only until the year of freedom. And I assume that's the year of Jubilee. Who are the servants? Well, here are two options. They can be false ministers of the gospel, according to John Gill. That's problematic. I'll discuss that further in a minute. Or it could be literal servants of the prince. And this, of course, would assume that the prince is not a type of the Messiah, but is rather somebody else, as some commentators assume, but which I don't. So we're not left with too many options here. Well, let's assume that the prince is the Messiah. Who could be the Messiah's servants? Now, here's my extremely speculative attempt to answer this, because I looked in a whole bunch of commentaries, and nobody seemed to think that this question was worth even asking. So I've got nothing to go on. I've never even heard the subject discussed anywhere. So these are my speculative thoughts. Option number one, the servants are also Christians because Christians are servants of Jesus as well as sons of Jesus. But the problem with that is, how do the servants of Jesus receive an inheritance from Jesus and then have to give it back to Jesus at some time? What would the year of Jubilee be? So I wasn't happy with that thought. And so then I considered option number two, the servants represent unsaved people. What do they inherit from Jesus? Well, they inherit common grace. They live on the earth. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. They're able to live without being executed by God, by Jesus, for the sins they commit. They live in a world which, although it is red with tooth and claw and cursed, it's still not as bad as it could be. Common grace. They experience common grace until they have to give what they received, common grace, back to Jesus at the end of the 49 years, speaking metaphorically, speaking typologically, the year of Jubilee. They give their inheritance back to Jesus and they lose their common grace, because when they die, there is no more common grace. There's only judgment. So the servants represent the unsaved. They inherit common grace as long as they are on earth. The servants' inherited property that they receive from Jesus, from the prince, is common grace. And then the servant loses his property, common grace, when he dies. The return of the property to Jesus represents Jesus taking the servant's life. Now that might sound a little far-fetched, but John Gill says that these servants are false ministers of the gospel, which is somewhat along the lines that I was thinking, although not exactly. I'll leave that one for you. That's the best I can do. Now in verse 17, the servant keeps his inheritance until the year of freedom. Now, the Cambridge commentator mentions as an option that that could be the seventh year of the indentured servant contract. Remember, in the Old Testament law, Hebrew quote-unquote slavery was really indentured servanthood. You could be a slave for 6 years, and then at the end of the 6 years, you went free. But the problem with taking the year of freedom to refer to that seventh year is that there was no reversion of property then from the slave back to the slave owner. And so the pulpit commentator denies that option and affirms that this year of freedom is the year of Jubilee, and I think that makes more sense to me. It's a minor point. We go now to Ezekiel 46, verses 19 through 24, and we will be finished with this difficult chapter. Verse 19, then the man brought me through the entrance at the side of the gate. Who's the man? That's the man mentioned first in Ezekiel 40, verse 3. He brought me there, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. With a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand, he was standing by the gate. That, I think most commentators agree, is Jesus, who appeared to Ezekiel in the vision and took him to the Temple Mount in the vision. So Jesus brought Ezekiel through the entrance at the side of the gate to the sacred rooms facing north. Now the gate to the sacred rooms is the gate on the inner court, because once you go through the inner court, you end up in the sacred rooms into the sanctuary. So that's the north gate of the inner court. But now there's an entrance at the side of that gate, and that probably refers to an entrance by the side of the north gate of the inner court. Maybe. I don't know for sure. That's one commentator's view. Those prepositions, even in English, are so confusing a lot of times, and in Hebrew too. But at any rate, Ezekiel comes in through the north wall, let's put it that way, and he showed Ezekiel a place at the western end of the sacred rooms facing north. I just said the sacred rooms were the sanctuary. Actually, the sacred rooms facing north were the priest chambers, those three-storied chambers, a set of two three-storied chambers that the priests lived in. I've gone through a great deal of detail describing them in chapter 42. And Jesus shows Ezekiel a place at the western end of those priest chambers. And he says in verse 20, the man did, Jesus said to Ezekiel, this is the place where the priest will cook the guilt offering and the sin offering and bake the grain offering to avoid bringing them into the outer court and consecrating the people. Now, the room at the western end, I'm looking at my picture here, is the room where offerings were boiled and baked. If you recall my description of the priest chambers, they were two rows of three stories each with a walkway in between, and the outermost row of priest chambers that were three stories high had the ends chopped off, and there was a one-story room on the eastern and western end of the priest chambers structure. The room on the western end is where offerings were boiled and baked. The room on the eastern end is where burnt offerings were washed. And remember, this is next to the temple in the inner courtyard. Now, those rooms were for preparing offerings, and the offerings that are mentioned in verse 20 are the guilt offering and the sin offering, and the grain offerings that go along with those. And these are offerings, of course, that the people did not share in. They didn't eat any of these offerings. And so the idea here is that the priest will take care of all their offerings deep within the inner court so that people on the outside, either at the front of the inner court or in the outer court, wherever they ate their peace offerings, these people on the outside would not be touched by the priest. Now, if they are touched by the priest's holiness, their separateness, their consecration would be passed to the people, and the people would become holy, and then they would be subject to all the typical Levitical laws. We talked all about that when we discussed the book of Leviticus. We don't want to make common people holy like the priest, and so we separate the people out from the priest. The priests do all their duty near their chambers, deep within the inner court, close to the temple. In verse 21, the man in bronze, Jesus, then brought Ezekiel to the outer court and led me around to its four corners. So you go to the extreme edge of the temple complex, the outer court, and look in four corners, and I saw in each corner another court. In other words, there were four squares in the corners of the outer court. And the four corners of the outer court were enclosed courts, and I'm assuming that's enclosed on the sides, not on the top, 40 cubits long and 30 cubits wide. Each of the courts of the four corners were the same size. Around the inside of each of the four courts was a ledge of stone with places for fire built all around under the ledge. In other words, there were kitchens to cook stuff. You light the fires, you heat the stone, you cook the food on the stone. Verse 24, the man in bronze, Jesus, said to Ezekiel, "These are the kitchens where those who minister at the temple will cook the sacrifices of the people." Well, what are the sacrifices of the people? Those would be sacrifices that the people shared in when they offered offerings to the priest, and that, of course, is the peace offering, also called a fellowship offering. Fellowship, you share. Fellowship means to share. And, of course, it would be more convenient to cook those sacrifices on the outside because the people are going to be sharing in those sacrifices. Now, of course, there would still be the danger that these priests might consecrate the people, might pass their holiness to the people. But there's less of a chance than if the priest had to cook all of their offerings in the outer court. Only the peace offerings are cooked in the outer court. Now, you will notice this is all very similar to the Old Testament tabernacle and temple. I say very similar. I mean, there were sacrifices. All of these kitchens and such are not mentioned anywhere except in Ezekiel's temple. And by that, we see both continuity and discontinuity. There's continuity with the Old Testament because obviously Old Testament laws and sacrifices and rituals have been constantly mentioned through this chapter and the previous. But there's also discontinuity because things are different. The sacrifices aren't the same. The temple looks different. It has different rooms, different structures, just like the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. There's continuity between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. But there's a lot of discontinuity, too, because the New Covenant is a new thing, and Ezekiel's temple is a new thing. Even though there's continuity with the old, it is still fundamentally a new thing, just as the Church of Jesus Christ is fundamentally a different thing, a different covenant than that covenant with the people of God in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant. Now, a few more minor comments, and we'll finish this difficult chapter. The four corner kitchens on the outer court are said to be enclosed in verse 22. Many think, on the contrary, these courts were open and unroofed to let the smoke out. Well, most all translations have enclosed, but enclosed could mean the kitchens were enclosed on the four sides, not enclosed on the top. So that's just a translation issue. Interestingly enough, Young's literal translation here has the courts were perfume courts, not enclosed courts, but perfume courts. That must be a translation issue. That sounds crazy. Now, the sacrifices of the people in verse 24 are said to be cooked in these corner kitchens. That would be voluntary free will offerings, of which the peace offerings were voluntary free will offerings were an example of peace offerings. Let me read you what Clark says about these offerings. Uncovered apartments, what Clark says about the kitchens. They were uncovered apartments where they kept fires for dressing those parts of the peace offerings which were made in the temple by individuals through a principle of devotion. On these their families and their friends feasted, and portions were sent to the poor, the widows, and the orphans. Typical peace offering. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished this chapter, which I previously described as difficult, and it was, and I'm so glad to be finished. If you made it through this far with me, I hope you will stay tuned for my discussion of Ezekiel 47, our next chapter, which I will entitle Water Flowing from the Temple. Now, I really like this chapter because the symbolism is very obvious, and it's got water flowing uphill. So I hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.